I invite you to turn to Psalm 18. I'm going to read one verse here in Psalm 18. I'm going to be looking at the remainder of the psalm, but this is the verse with which we want to begin. Psalm 18, verse 35. You have given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand supported me. And your gentleness made me great. We are engaged in a culture now where hateful public discourse is an ongoing and pervasive phenomenon. Before the internet age, public discourse was far more intermittent and intentional. Public discourse needed to be printed mainly or on the radio or perhaps on some TV shows like 60 Minutes or Meet the Press. But with the advent of 24/7 cable news and social platforms on the internet, public debate has become a constant, far more bitter, far more vitriolic and more aggressive. We are living in a time when human gentleness is being discounted more and more. It is not the gentle soul that is being heard, respected, and honored. It is the rowdy. It is the loud and the proud, the caustic, the unruly, the acerbic voice that is being heard in our society. But one does not win an online argument today with gentleness. It takes brashness. It takes combativeness. It takes invective and diatribe, harsh criticism. One no longer is required to engage others like a gentleman or a gentlewoman. The tactics of intimidation and crass language and threats are more the order of the day. Gentleness today is seen as weakness. It is seen as backing down. It is seen as capitulation. In our protest culture today, protesters cannot be seen to be gentle but forceful. They cannot be humble. They must be insistent. They cannot use language gently. It must be difficult and harsh language. They cannot dialogue. It must be to dictate. This is how to engage publicly today. This is how you voice your opinion. This is how you win the day, as it were, in this very combative society. Protests more and more are forceful usings of power, tactics like taking over public spaces, destruction of public and private property. The genteel, respectful, and gentlemanly protests of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. are a thing of the past. Several years ago, we began hearing the language of the radical left today, the neo-Marxist language that has kind of snuck up on us and is finding its fruition today. We heard talk about safe spaces, and we wondered what safe spaces were in universities, in public universities, and how speech that was not approved speech was to be denied a platform. Several speakers at different universities were shouted down because they did not accord to the radical theories of critical race theory and intersectionalism that began to get a foothold in our public universities and their populations. Any idea of genteel discussion went out the window and was replaced with chanting slogans that disrupted speeches and made it impossible for certain unapproved speakers to communicate their message. and they were shut down, and thus the cancel culture was born. And so gentleness in human relationships is continuing to give way to the loudest voice, the brashest statements, the brute mob power being employed to achieve certain ends. And just like almost all other Christian virtues, gentleness is being eradicated from public discourse. A sense of decorum has vanished. I think we saw this evidenced at the State of the Union this year when our Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi stood behind President Trump and tore up very deliberately, very dramatically her copy of his speech. And that was a statement, an aggressive act of defiance and disagreement. She knew that the national cameras would be upon her to that. And this is far from the standard of gentility that we expect of our elected officials. And yet today it was and is defended as an appropriate thing to do. Our president today, I don't care what your politics are, less than genteel. Less than genteel. And the sad thing about all this is not that unsaved people will act like unsaved people. It's not that non-Christian people will act in non-Christian ways. That's expected. I expect that. The difficulty that I have and the concern that I have is it more and more and more is seeping into the church. It's seeping into the lives of God's people. It's become the modus operandi, if you will, of God's people to mimic the politicians, to mimic the cable news network talking heads, to mimic the internet displays of diatribe that we read. That's my concern, and I think that's God's concern. It's not that God is unconcerned with any sin that happens in the world, but his primary concern is you. His primary concern is us and how we interact in society, how we interact with the unsaved, how we interact with each other. How are we to do that? What is gentleness? What is gentleness? Baker's Evangelical Dictionary of Bible Theology defines it this way: sensitivity of disposition and kindness of behavior founded on strength and prompted by love. Let me repeat that. Sensitivity of disposition and kindness of behavior founded on strength and prompted by love. Well, let's take a quick walk through the Bible in terms of the manifestation of gentleness displayed by the Godhead and those who were followers of God in the Old Testament. Gentleness is suggested by the waters of Shiloh, or the waters of peace, gently flowing like a meandering stream, Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 6. Gentleness stands in contrast to baseness. Rather, it is tender and refined behavior, Deuteronomy 28, 54 and 56. And it stands against harshness, 2 Samuel 18, 5. Gentle, soft words are said to wield great power, Proverbs 15, 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, Proverbs 25, 15. Job's counsels, when he was at the height of his influence in his community before the tragedy betook him and his three comforters came and accused him. In chapter 29, he looks back to the days when his way was blessed by God, and how his words were heard, and he would come into the city gate and the young would rise and they would listen to his counsel. This is what he says of that counsel. He says he lightly dropped them upon others. He didn't smash them. He didn't bludgeon them with his words. He lightly dropped them upon others. Job chapter 29 and verse 22. Gentleness evidences itself in a willingness to yield, reminiscent of a gentle lamb being led to slaughter. Jeremiah 11:19, Isaiah 53:7. The supreme exemplar of gentleness is Israel's God. He cares tenderly for the flock under his care and, quote, gently leads those that have young, Isaiah 40:11. He discloses himself to Elijah. Remember when Elijah was running from Jezebel after the events on Mount Carmel and the prophets of Baal being slain and God answering by fire, and Jezebel promised to kill Elijah. Elijah flees to the mountain, and God comes to him and he speaks to him. But it was not in the wind that God spoke. It was not in the earthquake and the fire, but in a, quote, gentle whisper, 1 Kings 19, 11 through 13. His consolations are spoken gently, Job says in Job 15, 11. As Yahweh's representative, the Messianic King comes in humility and great gentleness, Zechariah 9, 9. But of course, the ultimate manifestation of gentleness is Christ in the New Testament. That King now come in the flesh is, quote, gentle and humble in heart, Matthew 11, 29. In accord with the prophecy, he enters Jerusalem in gentleness and lowliness, Matthew 21, 5. Paul appeals to believers, quote, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10, 1. By his Spirit, Christ cultivates the same qualities in his people, Galatians 5:23 tells us. Following Jesus' example, Paul treats people gently, quote, like a mother caring for her little children, 1 Thessalonians 2:7. He comes to them not, quote, with a whip, but in love and with a gentle spirit, 1 Corinthians 4:21. Church leaders are admonished to be not violent, but gentle toward persons under their care. 1 Timothy 3:3. It is a quality they are to avidly pursue. 1 Timothy 6:11. Knowing themselves to be subject to weakness, they can more readily deal gently with the ignorant and with the erring. Believers who are ensnared by sin are to be restored in gentleness. A witness to Christian truth is more effective for being made with gentleness and respect, especially toward a hostile or unbelieving listener, 2 Timothy 2:25, 1 Peter 3:15. Wives should seek the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love, exhorts Paul in Ephesians 4:2. Let believers clothe themselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, Colossians 3:12. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness. Galatians 5, 22 and 23. And so, we see all these characteristics of gentleness, but they seem to contradict the profile of many strong Christians, many really opinionated Christians who have a point to make and have an argument to make. And they want to make it in public, and they want to make it on the internet, and they want to make it in discourse in public ways. In Psalm 18, we read a psalm of David that describes God rescuing David from all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Look at the introduction to this psalm. to the choir master a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord rescued him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. 2 Samuel 22 is almost a total repeat of Psalm 18. There are some slight variations, but very slight. And we don't know which came first. We don't know if 1 Samuel 22 was written first or whether Psalm 18 was written. But Samuel 22 has to do with the narrative of David's life. And this, of course, Psalms, is an anthology of songs and poems that are a collection that create the book of Psalms. But this, both texts reveal to us something about David that is often overlooked. David was a warrior. David was courageous. He was a powerful man. He was a man that shed much blood. He was a leader. He had great authority. He wielded great power. And yet for all of that, he was not a despot or cruel man, but was a poet king. David was a flawed man, to be sure, and the Bible does not hide his flaws. But he was a man's man. You know, being a man's man today will get you into trouble. Procter & Gamble last year started an advertising campaign about toxic masculinity. And it basically said that any masculine traits, whether that be aggressiveness or whether that be leadership or whether that be strength or whatever it is, think of traits that you would think to be masculine, and all that was put under the rubric of toxic masculinity. And to be sure, there have been abuses by countless men down through the ages, just like there had been abuses in every aspect of society, in every organization, in every institution, in every relationship. There have been abuses. But this article seemed to want to convince men, which is kind of a weird marketing tool, you know, because, you know, men, Gillette, shavers, and all of that they were pretty much, you know, decrying men. And I don't know if they didn't want them to shave anymore or what the case was, but they called them toxic because of that. Well, David was a man's man. He had definitely masculine traits. But David adds one dimension to his masculinity that shows real masculinity to be fully orbed. David says in the last half of verse 35, and repeated almost exactly in 2 Samuel 22, 36, "Your gentleness made me great." God imputed to David, along with his biological traits, along with his personality traits, along with his strength, he added a biblical gentleness that completed his persona and his masculinity. Specifically, it was not David's warrior status that made him ultimately great. It was not even the fact that God had made him spiritually alive or given him the ability to write great music and poetry for the Psalms. What ultimately made David great is that all those masculine and spiritual traits were moderated by God's gentleness. Strength for strength's sake is not necessarily a biblical trait. Aggression for aggression's sake is not a biblical trait. Leadership for leadership's sake is not a biblical trait. But all the traits of biblicity tempered by the Spirit and monitored by God's gentleness produced in David a strength. And it's the kind of strength that we need today as well. This was the key to David's greatness as a king, as a warrior, as a worshiper, as a poet. He had the strength to be gentle. Let's look at this psalm in the context of what David says about how God rescued him and the three commodities it took for David to be the great and gentle king he was. I want to share them with you. First is this, the divine source of the strength to be gentle. What's the divine source of the strength to be gentle? David, strong man, strong leader, all of those things. But did you notice in verse 35 that David did not say, my gentleness made me great. He said, your gentleness made me great. His strong gentility was from a divine source. There's a threefold source here that we can find in this text. The first is the Lord, who is our reservoir. Verse 1, O Lord, my strength. Note, if you will, verse 32, the God who equipped me with strength. Verse 39, for you equipped me with strength. From whence comes our strength? Is it from ourselves? Is it from the power, the searing logic of our intellect? Is it physically? Is it financially? Is it personality-wise? From whence cometh our strength? Well, first and foremost, we need to realize that the divine source of our strength, our hope, our obedience, and our gentleness is God. We don't just gin it up on our own. Now, for a worldling, the source of any, you know, good or ethical thing about themselves can be attributed to any number of sources, personal motives, pride, personal advantage that they feel they get for being a kind person, feeling good maybe about themselves. But for the believer, if it is genuine, the source is God. Our strength comes from the Lord. He is the inexhaustible reservoir into which we tap. When I was growing up, my dad was a hard worker. He came out of the hills of Kentucky and he came up to Michigan in 1948 or 49. And he and his brother started a business and they worked long, long hours. And when dad would come home, he would work many more long hours on the house or on the yard. And on the weekend, he would do the same. He was just a hard, hard worker. And he expected his boys to be hard, hard workers. I didn't like that. And so what I would do is when there was a project going on, I knew my dad was doing a project. He was a great wall builder, right? For landscape walls, you know, he would build wall. And when I saw him building a wall, man, I made myself scarce. I would move from room to room. You know, I would go down into the basement. And then if I heard him outside, then I'd go into another place in the room. And I actually expended more energy trying to get out of work than had I actually just gone ahead and, you know, pitched in with my, but eventually he would find me. And then I would half-heartedly, you know, kind of do whatever he told me to do, you know, and scuff along and mumble and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I was a slacker, man. I was a slacker. When I got saved, I began to witness to my dad, and I knew that my life change would speak to him in this one particular area, and that was in a work ethic. And so I determined by God's grace that I was going to be his best worker, and whether it was around the house or whether it was in the business that I worked in that business with him. I was going to be his best worker. I remember one day I was working with another fella, and I had been witnessing to him for several weeks. This was during the summertime in between my freshman and sophomore year at college. And we were in this big, what we call a filtration bed, and the machine that would normally spread, the backhoe that would normally spread the gravel, did not have sufficient access to get the gravel where it needed to be. So he would dump, the operator would dump piles of gravel, And me and this other guy, we would have to shovel it. And man, we were shoveling and shoveling. And I was determined I'm going to be the best worker, and I want to show my dad. And we were going, and this guy was trying to keep up with me. Now listen, I was in my prime. I was in my prime, and I was just going. I was like a machine, man. I was throwing that gravel, and finally, he threw down his shovel, and he said, "Man," he said, "does the Lord give you your strength?" And you know, he didn't know what he said, because the answer was yes. The Lord had given me the strength. The Lord had given me the will to be the best worker that I possibly could be. The Lord is our strength. Listen, if you resist temptation, it's the Lord who is your strength. If you serve in any capacity, it is the Lord that is your strength. He is the reservoir of our strength. We tap in to that reservoir. That's the source of where our strength comes. The second source is the rock who is our refuge. Verse 2. A rock was a metaphor for a stronghold or a safe place. The Old Testament narrative speaks of the rock of Oreb in Judges chapter 7, verse 25, the rock of Etam in Judges chapter 15, verse 8, or the rock of escape in 1 Samuel 23, verse 28. These were fortresses. These were safe places. These were defensive places where you could retreat and you could protect yourself and you would be able to repel the enemy. It is so used here in this psalm, speaking of God delivering David from Saul and all the other enemies. His fortress, his stronghold, his refuge was God, his rock. Where do we run when we are in trouble? What is our refuge from the storm? Whether that's physical, whether that's financial, whether that's relational, whether that's social, whether that's familial. When we find trouble in our lives, where do we run? To whom do we go? What rock do we flee to when bad news hits? Should it not be the refuge of Christ? Should we not run to Him for our protection? Doesn't mean that we will not take practical steps to extricate ourselves from danger, but ultimately we know a sovereign God is our final refuge, and there's rest in that. There's rest in that. We are fast leaving behind the days when our culture, when society and the laws of the land were a refuge to Bible-believing people. There was a time when the very laws of our land, the social constructs, were in some sense a refuge because we had favored nation status as Christians. It was a Christian nation. And so when we needed refuge, we could always rest in the fact that, well, the society is Christian and we're at the top of the food chain, so to speak. Not so anymore. Not so. It's not a Christian nation. It's not a Christian culture. We can't run to that as our refuge anymore. We've got to run to Christ. That's the way it should have been all the time, right? Now we get the opportunity for that to be real in our lives. Here's a third source. The Redeemer who is our salvation. Verse 2. Where do we get our strength? From the Redeemer who is our salvation. You know what makes me strong? It is the fact that I have a Redeemer from whom I can never be separated. I like to say that the world, the culture, the government can do a lot of things to you, but they can't eat you, at least not yet. And they can only kill you once, right? But here's what they cannot do. They cannot take salvation from you. They cannot take the fact that you have a Redeemer, that you have been rescued, that you have been delivered into the family of God, and someday you will see God in the face, in the person of Jesus Christ, because of the salvation that cannot be taken away from you. They can take everything else away from you. They take your life, your earthly life away from you. They cannot take your salvation away. You know what that does for me? It makes me strong. It makes me able to endure what some might think unendurable. Our Redeemer, who is our salvation, makes us strong. So our strength, and thereby the strength to be gentle, has a divine source in God, our rock. A second commodity is this: the spiritual nature of the strength to be gentle. There's a spiritual nature to all of this. Verse 3, verse 37, verse 35, verse 50. Strength, whether it is physical, positional, or a function of personality, listen, it's fraught with danger. Whenever you have power, that's fraught with danger. That's fraught with the potential for abuse. The physically strong can bully the weaker. Bill Brulette was my scourge in junior high. Here he is. Oh no, that's John Travolta. But he looked like that. All right? Bill Brulette was, he was a greaser. All right? If you know the term, some of you younger kids don't know the term, I'm sure. But he was a greaser, and they were the gangs, you know, the suburban gangs probably, but the gangs, you know, they wore the black, you know, and they had the hair grease, and back in the day, now I understand this has kind of made a comeback, but these real long pointy toes in your shoes, you know, I think I've seen some of that recently. The toes on their shoes were so long, they literally, I'm not kidding, they had to walk up steps like this. And their pointy toes were supposed to be, you know, some kind of a weapon, you know, or something like that. Well, Bill Brulette had been held back about 16 years. He was shaving in the seventh grade, all right? He was burly, right? And he was bigger than the rest of us. He, you know, either he matured very, very quickly or he got set back a few years. And the first day of junior high, we're sitting in the gym. He's sitting behind me. I don't know, they're giving us our homeroom assignments or whatever it was. And he had this ring on his finger. And man, every now and then he just popped me in the back of the head with that ring. You know, and I was too afraid to say anything or do anything, you know. And so I just kind of, you know, and pop, he'd do me again. He said, now I understand. What's wrong with you, Pastor? I understand that you've been hit in the head once too many times. But he was my nemesis in junior high. And then we got to high school, and by my sophomore year, I had grown up, and I was the size I am now, approximately, and he had not grown a bit. He was still the size he was, and come to find out, he was really a small guy, you know? And he was a pitiful figure. He could no longer find his identity in bullying others. He had lost that physical power over others. Positionally, anyone with a strong position of authority over you can bully you in a non-physical way, but simply because they have positional authority over you. Personality-wise, there are some very strong personalities who wield their personality in such a way as to control others. This too can be a form of bullying. So physical, positional, and personality prowess is not the sole definition of strength. As a matter of fact, the greatest strength comes from a spiritually redeemed and regenerate person who is acting out the spiritual life that is within them in spiritual ways. That is strength. It's of a spiritual nature. Real strength is of a spiritual nature. David goes on to say, you have given me the shield of your salvation. David was a regenerate man. Now, physical salvation for Israel was always a picture of spiritual salvation. A real man is a spiritual man. That is what tempers the strength, so to speak. He's not just this gnarl of strength, right? He's a gnarl of strength. She's a gnarl of strength that has been redeemed and regenerated and made and shaped into a different kind of person. This is the kind of man that David was. Jesus was this kind of man. He was a real man. He was not afraid to go toe-to-toe with his enemies, either spiritually, intellectually, or even physically. See the two cleansings of the temple as evidence of that. But his strength and physical aggression was never sinful nor inappropriate. It was guided by the Spirit. And without this spiritual component to our strength over others, whether that's a physical or a financial or a positional or a personality strength, we can exercise that strength in ways less than gentle. So instead of being great, we fail. Jesus taught the principle of servant leadership. He gave great power. He gave great authority to the apostles, but he also gave them an example of the greatest among them being the greatest servant, being the most gentle, humble servant like he was. Well, here then is a third commodity, the practical aspect of the strength to be gentle, verses 20 through 27. There's a practical aspect to all of this. All God-inspired virtue, okay, or service flows from the grace of God and His empowerment in our lives. We know that. But there are practical aspects that go along with God's grace at work within us, which must accompany the grace work if indeed it is legitimate. David puts it in terms of, for instance, his righteous behavior, verse 20. Not wickedly departing from God, verse 21. Keeping God's statutes, verse 22. His blamelessness and guiltlessness, verse 23, he states the Lord rewarded him according to all of these things. David then makes a statement of explanation when he says in verse 25, with the merciful, you show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you show yourself pure. But man with the crooked, you make yourself seem torturous. What's he talking about there? He's saying that there's a spiritual, the point of these verses is that there is an internal spiritual dynamic that produces in a practical way mercy and blamelessness and purity, not in perfection, but the pursuit of those things, the desire for those things, the glint of those things in all of our lives. And when God sees that, He behaves to us mercifully and blamelessly and purely. However, the converse of that is, if you are crooked, He will be torturous to you. And so what He's saying is God's treatment of us, either reward or being torturous, is based in the practical outworking of the inner strength and salvation that God has effected in us. Again, all there by the grace of God working in us. Even the will to want to do those things, God provides. But if they're not there, then there's no legitimate proof that grace is really working in our lives. Well, the last 15 verses of the psalm are a rehearsal of the practical way and the historical reality of how God delivered David from his enemies, verse 39. And the ultimate praise David renders unto God in verse 49. But David, strong in the Lord and the power of his might, was great. David was great because of the gentleness of God that was assimilated into his character. This is what made David great, not just the fact that he was really strong. Listen, Stalin was really strong, but he wasn't great. Hitler, in his own way, was very strong. He wasn't great. What made David great was this, that it was all tempered with this humble gentleness. Not in perfection. David had his sins. David had his failures. And the Bible does not hide any of that. This is the characteristic of Jesus Christ, who was great and was known as the gentle and good shepherd. Matthew 11, 29, take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest to your souls. And those who are his under-shepherds, the pastors, are admonished in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, to shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge. But along with his greatness and his gentleness is his strength. His strength. Look at how many times the word rock is used to describe God in this psalm. In verse 2, it's used twice. It's used again in verse 31 and then in verse 46. That, of course, is one of the key metaphors for Jesus Christ in Scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. Look at the times the words indicating strength are used in this psalm. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 17, verse 32, verse 39. Beyond that, there are two large sections that have to do with the manifestation of God's power over David's enemies, verses 6 through 16, and then again in verses 36 through 48. And this strong, delivering rock is further identified by office in verse 50. Look at the last verse of the psalm in verse 50. Great salvation he brings to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. This strong, delivering rock is also the king, the anointed, and the offspring of David. All these speak of Christ. David didn't know what he was saying necessarily when he was saying this, but all of these are a foreshadowing of the office and function of Jesus Christ, the King, the Anointed. That's what the word Christ means, the Messiah, the Anointed. The offspring of David. He's called in the New Testament the Son of David. Well, I want to share with you three quick conclusions. Again, what made David great in the context of God's strength given to him was gentleness. The gentleness he got from God, just as he got his strength for life and service. This is also part of what makes Jesus great. Jesus is not great just because of his power and his purity and his strength and his majesty and his authority. All that is exercised and exists in the context of being a gentle shepherd to his people. Gentleness is not weakness. God is not weak, but he is gentle. David was not weak. Jesus was not weak. Paul was not weak, but they were all gentle and not ashamed to be so. So, do you want to be great? Do you want to be great as defined by these truths? Be gentle. Don't be harsh. Don't be authoritarian. Don't be brash, but be humble and gentle. I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. We might further conclude that gentleness is necessary to exercising genuine strength. Many have been called great down through the ages for things that they've done or riches that they owned or influence that they have wielded, and they've been called great because they were powerful or rich or smart or otherwise gifted. But were they gentle? Today, gentleness in our human interactions is being slain in the streets. Call it a function of decades of raising self-absorbed human beings. Call it a function of rabid individualism. Call it the proliferation of social media where we can hide behind a keyboard. Call it a rejection of the moral foundation of our society. But gentleness is rather low on the priority list today. Power is in. Harshness is in. Dogmatic argumentation, shouting down, ridicule, attack is in. All these practices in human interactions are in today. What seems to be out is the gentleness of Christ. It should never be so in the lives of those who belong to Jesus Christ. Yet I'm afraid in times like these, especially, we too far too often revert to the tactics of the flesh to express our opinion, our point of view, and position. Sometimes we use this kind of language to defend the Bible, to defend Christ. Is there anything more inappropriate? We do that. And in that, Christ is lost. Christ is forfeit. The gospel is tarnished. And lives are affected, but they're affected for the worse, not for the gospel. And so let us commit ourselves to have the strength to be gentle. As I close, here is some advice I would leave with you. Don't desire or attempt to win a battle because you are stronger than the other or can argue better than the other. Win a person. Don't be so concerned about winning an argument that you lose the person. Win a person. Because of your gentleness, even if you don't win the argument, thereby you will display Christ to them. You will display Christ to them, and that is far more valuable than winning an argument. Please stand with me and receive this benediction. O God, you who are gentle and tender toward us, grant that we would look to you for our strength, but then employ that strength with gentleness, to the end that Jesus Christ and his gospel might be clearly seen by a world sorely in need of the Savior. To that end, dismiss us from this place. Amen and amen.